Support comes from New York State United Teachers, a union of professionals standing with more than 600,000 workers in education, human services, and healthcare with the Our Voice, Our Values, Our Union campaign. And United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President. UUPinfo.org.
It's the Capital Connection. Hi, I'm Alan Chartok. Joining us this week is a guy who we really like, New York State Republican Assembly Minority Leader Will Barclay. Leader Barclay, good to have you back with us.
Well, thank you for having me on the show, and thank you saying you really like me. I don't start a lot of radio shows with people saying that, so I appreciate that.
One day, one of the leaders invited me to come. I don't know what he was thinking, but invited me to come and talk to his Republican group. And I got up there, and as I was walking off, a Republican assemblyman came in and said, "What the hell are you doing here?"
It's funny. Well, anytime you want to come and speak to the conference, let me know. We'll set it up.
There you go. Anyway.
You'll give us a perspective that maybe we won't get otherwise.
Right. That one wouldn't get otherwise. Exactly right. So, Will Barclay, I'll start with you. I once interviewed Harry Belafonte, and the first question I had for him was, "Donald Trump?" Question mark. So I'll change that this time to Andrew Cuomo. Question mark.
Yeah. Well, obviously he's facing a lot of challenges right now with the investigations going on by the Attorney General, by the U.S. Justice Department, and by obviously the impeachment inquiry by the Judiciary Committee in the Assembly. And I think there's good reason to be. He should be concerned. Obviously, you have the March 23rd executive order and the potential cover-up of what he did in the nursing homes. You have potential governmental employees working on his book, and obviously you have all the harassment claims coming out. I think there's six or seven women who are claiming harassment against him. We'll see where things go. I'd like to keep these investigations moving. I think the public deserves to know what happened, and if wrongdoing happened, then there needs to be accountability. So, as you saw yesterday, the Assembly Judiciary Committee met. They were in executive session, but my understanding is what they did in executive session was permit the law firm Davis Polk to issue subpoenas against two senior members of the Cuomo administration to try to get to the bottom of, you know, all those different allegations.
But it does seem as if there's some kind of quiescence about all of this, that there isn't the kind of buildup that you would expect if something was going to happen that would deny him either the right to run for governor again or to face impeachment. So is it your impression that he's off the hook?
I don't think so at all. I have no reason to believe that any of these investigations aren't moving in the right direction. In fact, obviously, anytime you're investigating someone as powerful as the governor, you want to make sure you have all your I's dotted and your T's crossed. So let's hope this continues. But again, I do feel like it can't drag out for 6 or 7 months. It needs to be done forthright, and the public deserves to have, some answers to these many allegations.
So do you think he'll be impeached?
I think so. I mean, my feeling was, and I think the majority of members in our conference think that we didn't even really need to do this full investigation. We should have just sent what the public out there in the public space right to the Senate and let them be tried in the Senate. As you know, unlike a criminal trial, this is more of a political type undertaking, and you don't need the still standard of proof. So I've always said I think his ability to effectively govern with this cloud over him would be very difficult. I thought he ought to resign because of the seriousness of the allegations. But short of that, I thought we ought to start the impeachment proceedings right away. I don't have any reason to believe, again, that the investigations aren't being thorough and they're taking their time on it. But I'm hopeful that whatever information is out there will help buoy the case so that when the impeachment does happen, it'll be a pretty airtight case.
So let me ask you this. There are those people who think that Speaker Hastie is actually helping the governor and that he will not allow an impeachment in his own assembly. What do you make of that?
Well, I think there's always, those types of allegations. I can't speak one way or the other. I'm not on the Judiciary Committee. We do have Republican members on that committee. Obviously, I'm not allowed to discuss with them the specifics that are happening. But I haven't gotten any indication from any of our members on the Judiciary that the investigation is not proceeding in an appropriate manner. So I'm not going to say one way or the other. I think time will tell, and we'll see how the outcome progresses.
Well, I respect the fact that you don't want to say it one way or another, but let me ask you to put your Johnny Carson crystal ball, on here. Do you think that Andrew Cuomo is going to be the Democratic candidate for governor? In which case, do you think that there's anybody on either side who can beat him?
I think he would like to be. I think he wants to run for a fourth term.
Sure.
I think, his father was denied that. And I think he has given every indication that he would like to run for reelection. Interestingly, again, I think his ability to govern has been compromised. So that's why I think he ought to get out of the way, either not run or resign would be even better. But interesting politically for Republicans, having him run may not be the worst thing in the world. Certainly there's plenty to run against this governor on. And so I'm torn, but I think the right thing is to pursue this impeachment, get him out of office, and then see where things go from political nature forward. I think it's just better for the state, frankly.
So, Leader Will Barclay, let me ask you this. Do you see anybody? And by the way, this is an honesty question, and honesty questions are defined by, if you don't tell the absolute truth, lightning will come out of the sky.
Okay. So I'm looking up at the clouds right now, but go ahead.
The two guys you have, up there now who have announced their interest in running as Republicans for governor, I don't think have a chicken's chance. One is Giuliani, obviously, the son of a guy who is just about to be disbarred or hovering around there. And the other, of course, is the same old guy from, Long Island, who doesn't have much of a chance because he's a Trumper in blue state New York. So can't you find somebody better?
Well, I do think the fact that you have interest from three candidates is a good sign. I mean, you have Giuliani, of course, but you have Astorino, and then you have Lee Zeldin. And Lee Zeldin, who probably could have won re-election to Congress, has a good war chest. The fact that he's willing to jump in this race and has already visited 62 counties, I think, is a good sign that, these people aren't dumb. They're not just doing a suicide mission. They think there's some possibility of winning. And of course, it's always hard in a state like New York to win, but certainly the other side, the Democrats, have given a lot for Republicans to run on. And history shows, no one gave Governor Pataki a snowball chance, and he pulled it off against the governor's father. So I would never say never. And I think there is possibility. You see the spikes in crime. You see the fiscal mismanagement. Fortunately, we're getting through the pandemic, but there are certainly a lot of problems, I think, with the governor's management and the acquiescence of the Democratic majorities to that mismanagement and during the pandemic. So I think there's a whole host of issues that Republicans can run on and run on successfully in a blue state.
I could argue Pataki with you because I thought Pataki was a moderate. And I also think that Pataki was a guy who was being managed by a master politician, Alphonse D'Amato. And I don't know about these guys, but I think D'Amato, he called me and he told me, we've got this guy and he's going to win. So he knew what he was talking about. I worry about whether or not you guys are committing sort of political suicide by putting up people who can't win. I like to see a close race. Oh, do you want to answer that one or do you want to move on?
Well, I think I answered. The only thing would say, the problem, whether, you suggested Zeldin was a Trumper, regardless of what, any Republican is going to be painted by the Democrats as a Trumper because they know his deep unpopularity in New York State. So I don't know how you get around that. You could nominate someone that might be considered more of a moderate, but they're going to be painted as a Trumper, just like they did with Molinaro last time. So I think the important thing is trying to get back to the ground game, which I think Zeldin, which I've seen, has been around get the base excited about his candidacy, raise money so you can get your message out, and then have that message be, I mean, Trump's no longer president. Have that message be on the issues where the Democratic Party has been failing New Yorkers. And there's a lot out there. I mean, how about losing 1 million people in population over the last decade? We can't continue on this trajectory in New York State. It's a defeating trajectory we're on. We need change, and just doing things more the same isn't going to make that change happen in New York.
So, Leader Will Barclay, do you have a candidate, I mean, a secret candidate in the back of your mind, you know, either Zeldin or Astorino? It sounds to me like Astorino may be your candidate, your secret candidate. Am I wrong about that?
I don't have any candidate right now, and I think purposely, for that matter, I think as leader of the conference and the assembly, it doesn't serve our conference well for me to get out there in front on this. So although I have told our conference to feel free for anybody who wants to endorse, if they are inclined to, you know, go ahead and do that. I know a lot of our members have endorsed Zeldin, which is good for them. So it's still early yet.
So now, is there any tying in of the hasty leadership of the assembly by a veto-proof majority with this gubernatorial election? Do you think if it goes badly for the Democrats that you could take back a whole load of seats?
Yeah, we're very optimistic on that. I mean, the one fly in the ointment with all that is redistricting. So we just don't know where the district lines are. But I would say we've been out there very aggressively recruiting candidates. And so far, the response I've had has been very positive. So I'm very optimistic. You know, in the past, Dems could try to point to whether it was President Trump or, you know, Republicans control the Senate or whatever, and try to obfuscate, you know, their responsibility for some of these problems. There's nowhere to run now. The Dems are controlling, obviously, the federal government. They're controlling the state government. So when you see bad results from some of these policies enacted by the majorities, they can't say, well, it wasn't really our fault. They'll try. I mean, I've seen it a lot with the spike in violent crime around New York. They say, well, it's happening around the country. It's not just New York. It's a pandemic, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, when it comes to actual policies that are passed, that aren't passed in a vacuum, they have effect. It's hard to defend bail reform. It's hard to defend the raise the age. It's hard to defend all these soft on crime pieces of legislation that are being instituted. And lo and behold, you know, you look at New York, you see New York City used to be one of the safest big cities in the country, has gone to one of the most dangerous big cities. And that doesn't just happen by coincidence. There's policies behind that cause this.
Speaking of which, we just had a mayoral election in New York, and we had this system of, you know, you put your top five people in, and, you know, if you don't get your number one choice, it goes to number two. Seems like it's pretty confusing. Not only that, but it does seem like there's a little bit of chicanery going on, either that or just plain old dumbness on the part of the Board of Elections, who seem to have political appointments as opposed to professionals.
Well, whether it's the professionals or just buffoonery, you know, the Board of Elections in New York City, this isn't the first time they screwed up. They screwed up, obviously, big time during the presidential elections, too. And it's part of the problems, I think. In fact, I think I saw this morning or yesterday, Wall Street Journal editorial on the problem with these election laws, that they've gotten so complicated. I mean, the ranked voting, I'm involved in politics, and I don't think I have a good grasp on how ranked voting works. But how does a, you know, man on the street figure it out? And I think it just causes a lot of confusion. People don't understand how their vote is being counted or weighted. And so, you know, I'm always just saying for more simplicity, let's just get back to what we are. You know, you vote for the person, and they get the majority of the votes, they win, they get into office. It seems to me the easiest way. The more complicated you make it, the more likely that problems are going to pop up like they have in New York City.
Let's go on, if we can, Will Barclay, to Trump himself. His organization and chief financial officer, Alan Weisselberg, were indicted this week by D.A. Cy Vance over allegations involving his tax filings. Does this damage him, the Republican Party, or you guys going forward?
Well, let's see what happens. As far as I know, there hasn't been any indictments against the president himself.
No.
Against people that ran the organization. And it seems like kind of, again, I'm not going to downplay it. I don't know what the motivations are by the prosecutors, but it seems like, you know, again, saying it's a minor crime, and it's a crime that's not often prosecuted, if I understand it right. It's how he reported some of the earnings that he received and some of the other executives at the Trump Organization received. It seems like more of a, instead of having a prosecutor, it seems like more of an IRS matter, but I don't know exactly. I don't profess to say I know the ins and outs of what the indictment is about. So we'll see where it progresses. I don't think right now it would affect the president any more than, you know, all the other stuff that he's got out there. This doesn't seem like anything earth-shattering, as far as I can tell, other than it's directly at the Trump Organization itself.
Now, let's go back, if we can, to the governor and Joe Prococo, one of his closest aide and friend. Now it turns out that the Cuomo family has been raising money for him and his legal defense. What do you make of that?
Well, you know, again, whether you want to support friends or not, I guess that's up to the individual person. I do find it a little bit troublesome because the governor has said, well, you know, we're going to let the cards fall where they fall. This is a huge betrayal of trust that he had in Prococo, and he made some statements like that's the end, you know. Yeah. But again, and then to find out that, I mean, I think it's very difficult to believe this governor who mismanages, wrong word, but he does mismanagement, but, you know, as a hands-on governor, I just have trouble believing he didn't know about this and authorize his family and associates to do this, and to claim he didn't know anything about it just seems to stretch the imagination there a little bit, the possibility that could be the case.
It certainly does, to me at least, the idea that he would say he knew nothing about it, because he is a micromanager if we ever saw one.
Absolutely.
So crimes are up. Homicides in the city across the state and country. But one of the things that the Democrats are saying, or many of the Democrats are saying, is talking about guns. Too many guns. There's got to be a way to rein in the guns. What do you make of that?
Well, I think that's always the boogeyman that the Dems always say. But then they pass legislation that doesn't really address what they're saying. For instance, most SAFE Act and others are pointed at long guns. They don't really deal with any of the most of the crimes done by handguns. And so, you know, I think a little bit disingenuous. I think they jump on, you know, they say don't let it, you know, tragedy go to waste. So they jump on it and try to push gun control measures that really don't get to the heart of the problem. And if really they're concerned about crime, again, I think they should be looking at trying not to pass additional soft on crime legislation. Let's go back and reform some of the bills, like the bail reform. Give judges discretion whether someone's a danger to the community, and instead of just saying the judge has to let out these dangerous criminals. That's, you're seeing a lot of people commit crimes over and over again, and they get released right back out of jail. The other thing, just generally, and this is not specific pieces of legislation, but this narrative of you know, defund the police and the police are the bad guys and women, I think is really dangerous. And I think that also is leading to spikes in crime. I know the morale in police departments that are very low. They're having trouble recruiting. They're having mass retirements because they're wondering if it's worth it. And they wonder if government has their back or not having their back. And these are the times I think we should be supporting our law enforcement officials versus trying to demonize them.
Yeah, well, I get that. But what about guys who put their knees on somebody's neck for 9 minutes and kill them?
He's being held accountable, right, though? Right? I mean, yeah. He was convicted.
Yeah.
So let's let the system. There's bad apples in any organization we have, but we shouldn't paint the whole organization like the police. Every police, you know, officers out there somehow a racist or somehow out to get people, because I, you know, the ones I know are really dedicated to the job and they're trying to do the right thing and ultimately want to keep their communities that they work in safe, work and live in. And so, I mean, I don't think you can just point out to bad problems here and there and try to paint the whole law enforcement community as being evil or. And then say we have to defund them. I think that's even more radical in the wrong direction to go in.
What got done during the legislative session this year that you're not happy about?
Well, I sort of outlined it a little bit, just in very general terms. I think there's fiscal mismanagement, and I also think there's public safety. We have not addressed that appropriately. So this session, other than the budget, which was a $212 billion behemoth, and raising taxes. They raise taxes on the millionaires, or something like $4.5 billion, and raise taxes on corporations by over $1 billion. So we're raising taxes by $5.5 billion. And ultimately, New York's already the highest tax or second highest tax state in the nation. We just cannot continue on the same trajectory we're on. It doesn't work. And as a result, as I said, we're seeing people leave New York State. So we have to change. We have to change what we're doing fiscally in New York State. We have to be more conservative in our spending. We just can't keep doing it. I remember at the beginning of last year, we said, oh, we're going to have huge budgetary fiscal constraints. It's going to be very tough with spending. And then the federal government came in, bailed us out, and we just spend all that money. I think we should rein in our spending and cut taxes. Ultimately, we need to cut taxes. We're just uncompetitive with our sister states and the rest of the world, frankly.
So what's wrong with them, with taxing the very richest among us, many of whom don't pay any taxes at all? What's wrong with taxing them more?
Well, the problem is they're very mobile, so they can leave the state much easier than, anyone else, I suppose. I mean, it's hard to get up and pack. But if you're already a Florida resident, you have a home down there, it's not very difficult to switch over and become a permanent resident of Florida versus New York. And we're seeing that happen. We're seeing that type of people that were New York residents, had homes in Florida, switching over and making their homes, or anywhere else, any other states for that matter, where they have a low income tax. So the problem is, ultimately, they'll just leave the state and we lose that. And New York is particularly an acute problem in New York because we're already a very progressive tax and system. And the more wealthy, we don't need to lose, 90% of our wealthy. If we lose 10% of our wealthy people, it's going to cause real fiscal problems because they already pay the majority of our state income taxes. And this New York City particularly, that's even more in New York City because they have an income tax in New York City. So that's the problem with this. You just can't go. I mean, my belief, you just can't go on and tax people forever without thinking there's going to be some consequence. They look around and say, what are we doing this for? I can go here and save, whatever substantial amount of money. No matter how much they love New York, it's hard when you look at the hard numbers to say, why am I staying in New York? What am I getting for being here other than trying to be a loyal citizen, I suppose?
Let me ask you a question. Do you think we've opened up too quickly with the COVID variants that we know are out there?
No, I feel just the opposite. I think we waited too long with it, although I am happy that it seems like we're coming out as, or maybe out of the pandemic. And there's always risk. I know there may be other variants out there, but, we'll have to deal with that and see how they come. But we cannot live our lives, constantly in shutdown. It doesn't work, I think, for anyone's mental wellness, but it certainly doesn't work for any the economic wellness of the state. So I'm glad we finally are opening back up. I think we could have even done it earlier. I think there's been this whole mess of arbitrary and contradictory type policies during this pandemic that I think were unfortunate, whether the mask mandates, whether it's masks in schools, whether it's, a curfew when to go to bars, whether it was the restriction on indoor dining, restrictions on religious services, all these directives that came down from above, turns out, I'm not sure they're based on any good public health policy or health, any trying to keep the public safe. Turns out they didn't have any bearing on that at all. So I feel very strongly that we should have opened up earlier, and I'm glad that we are finally opening up now.
We're speaking to Assembly Republican leader Will Barclay. It's interesting, and I'm glad you're here giving your side of this, but let's talk a little bit about redistricting, Will. New York is losing a congressional seat because of 89 people who didn't answer their doorbells. What do you make of what's going to happen now? The Democrats have enough votes, to put it mildly, screw the Republicans very badly. And I'm assuming that that's what's going to happen. How do you counter that?
Well, it's very tough. The only difference that we have now that we didn't have in the past is we have the Independent Redistricting Commission, albeit it's not as strong as I would like or not as independent as I would like, but at least it's a step in the right direction. My only worry is, as you may be aware, the majority's pushed through a constitutional amendment that will further weaken the minority's voice on that so-called independent redistricting commission. So while I have a little bit of the airways, I would urge all your listeners to please vote against that constitutional amendment that's coming up in November. But nevertheless, that is a little bit on the good news, is at least there is a third party looking at these lines. The problem is, of course, if the legislature doesn't like those lines, they can ultimately just end up drawing their own, and those would go into effect. So we may end up being right back to where we've been in all these other past, you know, redistricting decades, and just have, particularly in the assembly, which we're a victim of, we tend to gain seats and then get up to redistricting, and then we get redistricted out of a number of seats and we lose them. We have to start building up again. So it's a problem. I would like to see a stronger independent redistricting commission than we currently have, but at least that was a step in the right direction. We shouldn't move back by passing a constitutional amendment that's going to further weaken the minority's voice on that independent redistricting commission.
We've been speaking to our friend Will Barclay, who is the Assembly Minority Leader. Will, it's always a pleasure to talk to you on Capital Connection, and we hope you'll keep coming back and giving us your view about the way that things work in New York State. So again, thank you for being with us.
I definitely will. Thank you very much, as always, for having me on.
Support comes from New York State United Teachers, a union of professionals standing with more than 600,000 workers in education, human services, and healthcare with the Our Voice, Our Values, Our Union campaign. And United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President. UUPinfo.org.